just in case any of you think you might be in the wrong room, this is Creative Campus. We're going to be talking about the relationship between relationships, plural, between higher education and the arts. And as the program says, the focus really is on the multiple and meaningful connections between those two large sectors in American life, which have been underexplored, underarticulated, and not sufficiently leveraged. That is, the arts are not being sufficiently leveraged, we believe, in this group, we can say it, are not being sufficiently leveraged by higher education. It's a program that stems from an American Assembly convening that took place in the spring of 2004. I'm going to be talking a little bit more about that, a convening that led to a set of findings and a set of recommendations that we want to share with you. And particularly, we want to get some feedback from all of you because we hope to be pushing this work forward in the near future, in fact. So I have three wonderful panelists who are, I hope, going to do most of the talking for the subject and for me. All three of these people were at the American Assembly that we're going to be talking about. And, in fact, each of them and I played leadership roles at that assembly. Sandra Gibson and I were the co-directors of it, and the assembly on the training, sustaining, and presenting of the arts in higher education was actually the idea of Sandra Gibson, who brought it to the American Assembly and to me. I'm going to ask just a minute, I'm going to ask each of these people to introduce themselves very, very briefly. I'll let you know what the format is for this session we will share, and then we'll get on with it. After the very, very brief introductions, we will each talk briefly, and we'll take quick questions after each presentation if people have them so that we don't have to wait for everything till the end. I'll try to summarize a little bit briefly after that, and then we'll throw our topic open to all of you because we need your input. Our findings need your commentaries. I'm going to talk about the assembly process, just to put this whole thing in perspective. Steve Levine is going to talk about the... Where are you, Steve? There you are. I'm surrounded by Stevens. Steve Levine is going to talk about the academic implications of the Creative Campus convening and the report that was produced. Sandra will talk about the creative role of presenters, both at the assembly and moving ahead. And Stephen Tepper is going to talk about the research agenda on the relationship between higher education and the arts that has emerged from that assembly, and about anything else concerning the research dimension that he wants to speak about. So that's the plan, and we'll try and leave plenty of time for commentary and questions. Let's introduce ourselves very briefly. I'm Alberta Authors. I know a lot of you. I've been in whatever business I'm in for a long, long time. I've been in higher education and was for a long time, and that's one of the reasons that I'm so enthusiastic about this project we're engaged in. I taught and played administrative roles in several American colleges and universities before I went to the Rockefeller Foundation, where I work both on the humanities and on the arts. And now I'm an independent being made use of by people like Sandra. So that's me. Let's see. Stephen?
I taught at the University of Michigan. I was associate director under Alberta at the Rockefeller Foundation. 88, I came to CalArts, where I've been president since. Our latest big venture, I hope some of you visited yesterday, Red Cat, the Roy and Edna Disney CalArts Theater at the Walt Disney Concert Hall, which actually plays directly into our subject today.
Great. Can everybody hear us? We're a bit low, all of us?
Is this even... Yeah. Do we have to lean in?
So we should speak louder. Okay. Sandra?
Sandra Gibson, President and CEO of the Association of Performing Arts Presenters, which is a national art service organization for the presenting and touring field. I've been there for about 5 years, fourth president in 40-some years. The organization was founded by college and university facilities managers about 48 years ago, and today has about 1,700 organizational members in a variety of contexts, including the agents, the managers, and the touring companies themselves that tour. I'm a musician by trade, an ethnomusicologist. I started my career at UCLA on a college campus, and I've always had a campus affiliation. So this is a project that's very near and dear to me, not just because I'm at Arts Presenters, but because I know of the power of the work that the arts can do throughout a campus. So I'll stop there. You'll learn more later.
Stephen Tepper, I'm the Associate Director of the Kerb Center for Art, Enterprise, and Public Policy, and I'm the Professor of Sociology at Vanderbilt. I formerly was at Princeton. I helped build a center there called the Center for Arts and Cultural Policy Studies, and I've been at Vanderbilt for a year. I write and I do research around cultural conflict, cultural participation, artists, and creativity and innovation. So this is my piece that... relates to all of those things, I suppose.
Why is it called Kerb?
Kerb, Michael Kerb, Kerb endowed it.
Record mogul.
Owns the largest independent record label in the country.
So my quick shorthand for the assembly that we held in March of 2004 is that we're eager to help the academy, higher education, understand the extent to which it already supports the arts in American life. And to push that further, our intention was to help the Academy understand that it has the same obligation, commitment, mission on the art for the arts, or should, that it already sustains for science, medicine, foreign language study, sports, you name it. These are all arenas within which the Academy acknowledges that it takes leadership on behalf of the American society. But the arts, which in fact it's deeply invested in, has not yet risen to that level of attention, that level of advocacy, that level of financial support, that level of attention from the top of the Academy that these other areas, arenas in American life do. So in a sense, we were bringing the Academy and the arts worlds together to begin a much more articulated discovery about what they share and how important they are to each other. It was a very exciting few days that we spent together. I like to think, a little like Molière's character, who was talking prose and didn't know it. I think the Academy speaks the arts and has not really acknowledged the extent to which this is true, and the extent to which it's important in the life of arts and culture in the nation. So there's a lot to learn about that. Just a few words about the American Assembly, which was our convening platform for this. The American Assembly is a convening instrument located at Columbia University that was actually started by Dwight Eisenhower when he was the president of Columbia, because he believed that there was no place, no locale, no location in the country where people interested in the same subject, same issue in American life, but coming at that issue from different perspectives, often different political perspectives, could come together to try to find consensus across an important issue in American life. It has treated subjects of many, many kinds over many, many years, and it always produces a report at the end of a convening which speaks to the issue from that diversity of perspectives and that tries to find a policy platform that people can share to move ahead on an issue. This assembly was a bit different because there weren't deep political divides, as there often are on issues. What there were levels of incomprehension or lack of communication across the sectors that we'd brought together. So it was a little different in that sense. We've been working on the arts through the American Assembly mechanism for some time. Frank Hodsell and I co-directed three assemblies, one on the arts and the public purpose, which really got a lot. It it seemed to resonate, and we were very happy about that. We did one after that on what we call deals and ideals, the relationship between for-profit and not-for-profit arts. There's a report on that. We did one on art, technology, and intellectual property, a very complicated subject. All of those have had a certain degree of follow-up and a certain, I think, set of effects. We hope they do. And this one on higher education in the arts, which Sandra and I co-directed, I think is the one that may, in fact, have the most follow-up, direct follow-up of the assemblies that we've put in place so far. We collected 68 or so people from across the populations that needed to talk about this subject, from college presidents and provosts and faculty members and deans to funders, artists, art association heads. Who else was there, Sandra? It was a journalist. It was a
critics,
scholars, wide set of people representing all the interests that needed to be poured into this vast subject. We left, as the assembly always does, we left the meeting with this report. There are copies of it below, which touches in what I fear is still quite a superficial way on all of the issues that are embedded in this very rich subject, which we want to pursue. So I'm going to let my companions at the table take up some of the issues that were raised and touch on aspects of the assembly and its results. But we'll try and give you the best sense we can of the whole thing. Does that help so far? If so, we'll plunge on with Stephen, who's been asked to think about how the academics fit into all of this.
I'm a little bit under a false umbrella as an academic, since CalArts is...
Speak up, Stephen.
I'm a little under a false guise as an academic, but CalArts is a college, so I guess I count. Alberta has this wave about once every 5 years getting me involved in an endeavor that crystallizes the thinking I was struggling toward and then takes up my life for the next 5 years. Probably many of you have.
She's had that effect on all of us.
Yeah.
That's
your job. I think for all of us who attended this meeting, once you started to state the links, it was so obvious that you wondered why you hadn't thought about it all along. I mean, the overwhelming majority of the artists in America are now prepared for their art career. Paid professional artists. There's other kinds of artists as well. Prepared for their careers at the university. At the same time, all the audience data suggests that the overwhelming majority of the audience that pays to go to the arts in America is educated into whatever appreciation of the arts they have, in part by their time at the university. Beyond that, in most cities, the most active and often the most progressive presenter of the arts turns out to be the university. I dare say if you look at Los Angeles, the two most progressive presenters in Los Angeles are UCLA Live and now Red Cat CalArts downtown. And I think most people would agree with that. For me, the most important and least understood aspect of this, and I thought even least understood at the assembly, is that the university already is almost surely 50% or more of the subsidy for the arts in American life. We all acknowledge that literary writing in America, poetry and literary fiction, there are only 50 writers in America who support themselves, literary writers, on their publishing. The rest are supported by being employed as faculty in writing programs and English departments. Whether you look at costume designers and set designers, I mean, Ming Cho Lee, people who have big Broadway careers, they still end up being at universities as their home base. Increasingly, best choreographers in the country, many of them are at universities across the board. And that doesn't even count the countless artists who go to universities and make their livings by basically doing workshops in one university after another. So we are deeply in it. And as Alberta says, I don't think most universities have taken an account of how big an investment they're making already in the life of the arts in America. And once you realize that, I think there's two directions you can go. One direction I would loosely put as the Lee Bollinger University of Michigan, Columbia direction, which I'll say only one word of because I know Sandra knows much more about this than I. But it's recognizing that what is presented by university presenters can, in fact, have a huge affective as well as cognitive effect on the learning of students across the disciplines. And that translates into tying what's presented to curriculum in much more interesting and complex ways than was historically the case. I think a lot of that's going on now, but again, that's not my territory. I'd leave that.
I'll tell a couple of stories.
At the other extreme, there's places like the Tisch School of the Arts and Juilliard and CalArts who are thinking in varying degrees about the contribution we make, not just by educating students, but toward the professional ongoing life of the arts in American life. I first realized this in the 80s when I went to see Robert Wilson's realization of Heiner Müller's Hamlet Machine at NYU in a student production. Well, I had no interest in NYU students. I wanted to see Hamlet Machine, and this was going to be my only chance in America in that decade to see Hamlet Machine. And frankly, it made no difference that it was fundamentally no difference that it was a student production under Robert Wilson's care than if it had been his professionals. I got what I needed from that. Or you can take the Juilliard's new music festivals each year, where most of the compositions are premieres that are getting their first hearing in New York City. And I think you can multiply that many times over in terms of what actually is available in the arts in American life. I think given the current weakness in the environment for the creation of progressive work, colleges have to, would do well to seize on this in an even deeper way. First, to recognize that, you know, when we employ scientists, we understand they need laboratories. We don't employ scientists, but when we, those who do, and that you're wasting them if you don't end up sponsoring their research. That's what you hired them for in the first place, plus the ability to teach. And if they don't do the work, then they're less use to you, as well as you've damaged the development of their field rather than helping it. And so provision is made. Universities that employ artists far too rarely think about the fact that having brought the artists into the university, they can either have the effect of stifling their careers, or in fact they can make provision for fostering their careers. And the analogy, as Alberta said at the beginning, is if you realize that both are ways of creating knowledge, that, I mean, to me it's not rocket science. It's just you have to think it, and then you have to find the resources to make it possible. I'm trying to. I read this over this morning. I realized it was far too long, so I'm trying to.
I think we're all going to be edited.
We speak. We're doing that.
So what I'm proposing, really, and I think this is happening, but I don't think it's understood that it's happening. I think it was not even reflected in Alberta's introduction, which still assumes that somehow education ought to support artists somehow outside the university to come into the university, as opposed to recognizing the artists are there in large number, and how do you help them realize? And I first learned this from Alberta when she talked about inviting the Pittsburgh Public Theater to use the facilities at Chatham College, and her theater department going nuts over it, when in fact it should have been the ideal opportunity for her theater students, and in a way have been thinking about it ever since. I apologize, I'm going to give some examples from CalArts because CalArts is what I know. But if I were at Michigan or if I were with Nancy Cantor at Syracuse or at Princeton, I mean, there's lots of examples one could collect now. I'm just going to name two initiatives that we've taken in this direction. One is Red Cat, which some of you visited, and the other is the Center for New Theater, which is the professional production arm of our School of Theater. Red Cat we present, last week it was DJ Spooky, this week it's B.B. Miller, but it's an accident that right now it's two things from out of town. At another time you might have come and seen Travis Preston, the head of our directing programs, realization of a 75-minute piano work composed by the dean of our music school, which was subsequently invited not to the Edinburgh Fringe, but to be a main feature at the Edinburgh Festival, and is touring the festival circuit in Europe. It's significant that it's not touring the United States because the system has not yet learned how to go inside the university and outside the university in terms of the passage of work, except through presenters doing co-commissions, which is a little bit different activity. We started a few years ago something called the Center for New Theater, recognizing that, in fact, regional theater in America does not have the finances to do the kind of work that we associate with things like the Brooklyn Academy of Music or the Lincoln Center Summer Festival, and that, in fact, by and large, those institutions don't have the funds for it. They present the work. They don't create the work. The work tends to be created with other money in other places, and often not in the United States because the mechanism no longer exists for it to be, often within the European Union now, which I think has actually seized the lead from the United States in terms of what is progressive and possible in the arts, which is an amazing reversal from 20 years ago. It began for us with a large-scale production, all-female production of King Lear, involving actresses on our faculty, professional actresses, alumni and students, subsequently invited to a major festival in France on their dime. This is students now and alumni getting equity points for participating in the kind of production you hope they will grow up to be involved in, as opposed to the sort of much of the middlebrow work that exists out there now. That's a different subject. Last year's production of Macbeth with Stephen Delane, this is probably a good example of what the university can do. Great actor, Stephen Delane, you probably saw him in The Hours, he won the Tony on Broadway for The Real Thing. He and a director in our faculty had always wanted to do a one-man version of Macbeth, which is the play by Shakespeare in which the most language comes out of the title character. There was no place in America to develop that work because the scale of what was being asked of the actor, you couldn't do it in a four-week rehearsal period or a six-week rehearsal period. You frankly couldn't do it in a unionized environment. They spent 4 weeks at Sundance. They spent 6 weeks over the summer when our theaters were empty anyway in a space at CalArts. Well-received here. It opens later this week at the Almeida Theatre in London. It'll tour five cities in Australia. Again, significantly, the American system has not learned to value enough what might be generated from inside the university to see how it actually ought to be traveling inside the United States as well as outside the United States. And I'll give one last example, and then I'll draw my conclusion. And again, I apologize that it's us. I deliberately started with the Heiner Mueller because that's where we learned it, and that was NYU, not us. I mean, this is in the capacity of all sorts of schools. And you could probably take the opera workshop at, University of Indiana. And say, what's wrong that those works, which are often world premieres, don't get seen outside of Indiana? Clearly the Metropolitan Opera singers are better, but where are you going to see that work unless it gets into circulation? So it's inside out. I'll do one last thing. As a result of the stuff we've done previously, the French government came from us. They wanted to arrange the American premiere of the playwright they consider their greatest living playwright, Michel Vinevere. He'd written one work in English, 11 September 2001. They chose to invest the money in a university because, in a way, they realized it was cheaper than investing it in the arts not-for-profit sector. Paid to bring his director, Robert Cantarella, from France, paid to bring his lead actress. The production was entirely done by students under their direction. It will transfer this next August to the Théâtre de la Colline in Paris as part of their regular season, with the only other American product being a Model Minds piece. You get the point. In each case, and this is the point and where the university needs to learn, this took extra investment by us. These productions cost hundreds of thousands of dollars. Not this last one, but the earlier ones. That we had to find. To justify it, it had to also be part of our educational process. And in fact, imagine what it is to be a young acting student meeting daily with Stephen Delane, who's preparing to do all 34 roles in Macbeth. To be one of the greatest actors of our time as part of their educational process, and in the heat of his making. So, as I draw toward my close, I'm pretty much on time, right? Close.
Thank
you.
Yep, quick.
We recognize that the literary world has basically survives in the university. It has pros and cons to that. Far too many academic novels. Everything has its limits. We recognize that by and large, until quite recently, serious music composition in America survived only through the university. Pros and cons. Some would say that serial music lasted far too long and Milton Babbitt's influence was far too profound because the university was a sheltered environment in which they didn't have to withstand the marketplace. I don't personally believe that view. I still think that's my trend in music. And if you think about dance, which I think is the next art form that's moving into the university, think about where it began. Martha Graham at Bennington, Doris Humphrey at Connecticut. And think about Ralph Lemon now through Yale. Think about B.B. Miller at Ohio State. Think about David Rousseff and Vic Marks at UCLA. Think about Jawole Zolar at Florida State. In the collapse of the infrastructure for dance in America, the only place to turn is the university. Lots of universities have pretty good dance programs now. Some have very good dance programs. They have not previously had access, except as setting a dance, to choreographers in the heat of their careers as opposed to in the declining years of their careers. There is a synergy here that needs to be recognized, but it requires the university, and I think this goes back to the American Assembly's point, to recognize that having brought the choreographer to the university, they've taken on the same responsibility they have when you bring a scientist to the university, to foster their ongoing art making, which in part means letting them out of the university, but also in part means making the facilities and the opportunity available to them within the university. I think the synergy here is profound, and I think it is actually the frontier a lot of the most interesting art in America is going to live on in the next decade. The end.
Great, Stephen. Thank you. We can... Two things, and then let's take, if there are just some quick questions for Stephen before we move on. One is that the kinds of examples that Stephen cited are importantly unknown, under-acknowledged, uncounted on American campuses. So the basic facts about this are not available to us. And Stephen's going to talk about what we need to know. And the second is that in the context of our American campuses and universities, the kind of examples Stephen gave are seldom woven, supported, embedded in as magical and positive a way as they seem to have been at CalArts. And the Assembly talked a lot about artists as researchers and how do we add that up, how does it work, artists as full members of the faculty, artists as potentially tenured members of the faculty, artists on campuses and their relationship with their departments, other departments, with other faculty members, that there's not a set of answers to this question about where artists fit and how they function in the usual academic environment. Stephen's a little unusual. We're very lucky for that. But we wish it were richer in other places. Are there questions for Stephen?